This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy. Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. Today we're going to be talking about the media and politics. I hope everyone listening has voted or will be voting very soon. And one of the most important issues in this election, as in other elections, is a question of how the media covers politics, how it covers citizens, how it covers our candidates. And we're going to talk about that today with my friend and fellow colleague at the University of Texas in the Radio, Television, and Film Department, a pioneer in filmmaking and political coverage, Paul Steckler. Paul, welcome.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you on. Before we start with Paul, as always, we have our scene-setting poem from Zachary. Zachary, what's the title of your poem today?
Seasons of Knowing.
Seasons of Knowing. Well, let's hear it.
Late June, when Texas begins to melt and the air conditioner struggles to find its stride, in my bedroom, awake with my laptop hidden beneath the covers, watching England fall with all my senses because Brexit begs it that night, with the voice over the BBC only singing a funeral tune. Middle of August, when Texas begins to peel off the burnt skin that encompasses the whole state, only to burn the next layer in the ever-burning sun. Listening to the bulletin from Charlottesville, like FDR's day of infamy, I listen to the station, angry under the August fire. Early November, when Texas finally wakes up from its slumber in the sauna, only to find the guts of Thanksgiving on top of it. Watching Michigan, Pennsylvania slip through the hands of every television until it's only the shout through the hallway the next day, daybreak, dead afraid of dying. When it's June again and I'm trucking through Alabama, still roasted under the oppressive sky, hearing of children stolen so parents may be stolen so maybe a wall can fight against the blue sky. And I can't stop seeing, though what I see should never be seen. And suddenly it's October again, and I start to fall asleep in the classroom, 1 year older. And that afternoon, I vote at the library with my dad, see the lions in the cool rain, and wait.
That's very thoughtful, Zachary. What do you make of the media and news coverage in your poem?
Well, I think it talks about how the media fits into our everyday lives and affects our emotions, but also helps us have more empathy for different people. And at the same time, can sometimes lead us on a roller coaster of emotions.
Right, can contribute to a lot of emotions. Paul, one of the things you've done so well in your documentaries on George Wallace and Ann Richards and others is help us capture their personalities and emotions. How has media coverage of candidates like George Wallace and Ann Richards, and then, of course, more recent candidates like Rick Perry and Barack Obama and Donald Trump, how has it changed over the last 10 to 20 to 30 years?
Well, I think that the explosion in media, just the cable universe with so many channels and so many outlets and so many sources of information online with video, has just made political figures, you know, much more knowable in terms of seeing them. You know, you just see them all the time. It's impossible to get away from President Trump.
As much as you try.
No, on every single social media platform, you know, for every Fox News coverage of every rally over and over and over again, so that, you know, where there might have been some mystery about candidates in the past, you know, their private lives were kept private. You know, there is nothing private anymore. You take a look at this campaign, and opposition research is, you know, uncovering all kinds of things in younger candidates because they grew up in a period of time of social media, so that there were pictures online and there was video online, you know, and there was, you know, pictures of, you know, their recordings of their band online.
Right.
So that, you know, we live now in a 24/7, you know, I'm there, you know, on some sort of platform universe. And I think it makes our relationship to what we think we know about candidates that much different.
Hmm. How has it affected the way we talk about issues like healthcare or foreign policy?
Well, you know, when I was coming up as a political scientist years ago, the cliche was that people didn't have issue stances so much as they had preferences for parties and for candidates, and they would tend to associate those candidates with what they believed. Okay, so if I liked Jeremy, you know, I'd assume that Jeremy just agreed with me on certain issues. Now, remember, certain issues, some issues were important to me, And some issues I would just say one way or the other on a poll, and I didn't really care that much about, you know, so it ignored single issue voters. I think, generally everything that's happened in society over the last decade or so has led to sort of hyper-partisanship and greater division. If you take a look at, let's say, Bill Bishop's seminal book in 2004, The Big Sword, the stuff that Bill was writing about then, about how America was sort of separating, mm-hmm. In terms of their political views, their religious views, their social views, has just hyped up, and been reinforced by just the way social media and the media in general has opened up those things so that we live much more in a niche society. So I think everything has tended to split us, if that makes sense.
Sure. And what's interesting to me about your saying that is your own work has shown how partisan and divided Americans have been for so long. Mm-hmm. Take, your favorite candidate, George Wallace.
Right.
Right? The differences in views on race. Mm-hmm. In that time, however, though, the media seemed to bring people together, telling the stories of civil rights activists and others. Why is it different today?
Well, back when the civil rights movement happened in the 1960s, there were only three major networks. Even PBS didn't exist at that point. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have many venues to go to, and people actually read newspapers. There were lots of newspapers when I was growing up. New York had, they must have had at least five or six major newspapers. We were a Journal American family. You try to find New Yorkers that even know what the say Journal American, what that actually is. They had a really good sports section.
Gotcha.
If you were a Yankees fan, so that there was more of the possibility of having a conventional view of something.
Right.
There was a concept that was really important again when I was in graduate school called the socialization of power.
Hmm.
It was a concept that was written about by a guy with a fabulous name, E.E. Schatzner.
Oh, sure. Famous political scientist.
Yeah, I think from Wesleyan University. And he wrote a book called The Semi-Sovereign People.
Yes.
And the concept was that, let's say there's a political fight between me and your son, okay? And, I'm on one side, he's on the other side, but I've got all the ammunition. I've got all the people on my side, or the lobbyists, or the, more power. Okay, well, I win that fight unless your son is able to socialize the conflict,
right?
And to bring in a larger audience to be able to put more weight on his side. Okay, and there are classic examples of this in the 1960s. David Garrow, in his, again, seminal book, Protest at Selma, applied Schatznyder's view to what happened in Selma, Alabama, where left to their own devices, Southern blacks would not be able to vote. So if they get themselves on national TV getting beaten up, by mounted police, all of a sudden a national audience, is disgusted by it, watching it on TV that night on Sunday, and all of a sudden the Voting Rights Act happens, pushed through by President Johnson at the time. That kind of thing, the whole rise of the environmental movement, the rise of the feminist movement, all these things, happened in the 1960s, and I think they were powered to a certain extent, not only by social changes, but by a media atmosphere which made it easier to be able to figure out where to be able to illustrate what was going on, to be able to socialize your conflict. Today, it's just, it's much more difficult. It's kind of like people have their own places to go to be able to watch and to be able to watch people they already agree with. I know this is a cliche, Jeremy, but, the entire society has become much more niche.
Right.
And I live in one universe and somebody else lives in another universe, and it becomes increasingly hard to even talk about it, let alone be able to have some sort of a dialogue.
And you don't see the same dynamic, though, from Schatznyder and the semi-sovereign people with the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter, and perhaps on the other side with many of the white supremacist movements. How different is that?
Well, I think, to a certain extent, they are niche-oriented towards, their niches may be larger, but they come with, I think, a much greater amount of partisan division, racial or gender division that we've seen in the past, and there's obvious, backlashes on this as well that are fed, again, by going to your own corner.
Right.
And going to your own corner. I think a lot of Democrats, I think, have been very surprised that in the aftermath of the Kavanaugh hearings, what's the political legacy of that? Well, the political legacy short term may be the re-election of a Republican Senate. I mean, who saw that coming?
Right.
You know, I'm actually wondering if Dianne Feinstein sat on that letter, you know, because being an experienced politician, she took a look at this and she said there was a moral choice, you know, but this was a political loser for the Democratic Party.
Right.
You know, we have a midterm election coming up, you know, and this is a different way to read, you know, just the way issues work in today's world.
Right. So it might have reinforced both sides of the argument, which would help the Republicans in the Senate and the Democrats perhaps in the House.
You know, and this might happen, but it might have woken up the Republicans, you know, in an election where Democrats had all the enthusiasm. I mean, we'll see, obviously. You know, who knows? But it's I think that the idea that that it's hard to be able to have an issue that has one side where there's a consensus, it becomes increasingly hard, if not impossible, you know, in a world where everything is divided, where if I say something and I'm a Democrat and you're a Republican, you just naturally go to the exact opposite side. You know, it's our political system was based to a certain extent on compromise, you know, or some sort of compromises,
right.
You know, and now if you're a compromise candidate, you're seen as a total sellout,
right.
You know, on both sides. And I don't know where that leads to in terms of actually coherent public policy, you know, like, so.
Well, I think we'll get to that. But before we do that, I just wanted to focus on this issue with another question. How has this changed the way people in the media do their job? How is the job of a reporter or a documentary maker like yourself? How has that changed?
Well, I think for documentary folks, I think it puts more pressure on you to be an advocate as opposed to sort of a neutral arbiter, you know, of issues and you know, in history, because you're looking for an audience.
So, like a Michael Moore or Dinesh D'Souza.
You know, both of whom make films that, to a certain extent, I'm not interested in.
Right.
Okay, well, but there's an audience for both of them.
They're terribly predictable, aren't they?
Well, it's, you know, again, the beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't mind learning something and I wouldn't mind, you know, actually thinking for myself. You know, the problem for a filmmaker right now is exactly what do you put out there that allows people to think for themselves. You know, it's hard calculation. And also, you need to be able to raise funds. You need to be able to get people interested. You know, there's a reason, I think, you know, that, you know, some people, I mean, yesterday I was talking about Tucker Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew Tucker a little bit years ago. He's a great guy. What happened? It's kind of like, you know, this is a conversation I had, and this may be going to a different direction.
What happened?
Well, I think what happened was cable news, you know, and I think, you know, yesterday literally I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who was, you know, been very successfully involved in Republican national politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about how we thought that, you know, Fox News has been the worst thing to happen to American politics in generations. It's just horrible. You know, and I'm sorry to be, you know, sound partisan about this, but I watch, you know, Fox at night and I go, what universe are we listening to?
Right.
I mean, I'll give you an example. And this was like a few years ago, and stop me if this is going off message, but back in 2008, I helped produce Frontlines, a big documentary about the 2008 election, you know, McCain and Obama.
Sure.
You know, I thought we did a really good job, you know, and it was pretty, you know, pretty balanced. It was very balanced, you know, and we went out of our way to make sure that it was. They're both interesting guys.
Absolutely.
Interesting interplay. Fox News had their big historical film on one night, and I said I was curious to see how they would differ with us. You know, just their approach. And there was another 2-hour film, I believe. And they spent a large amount of their time tracing two Indonesian students who might have known Obama going back to Indonesia because they might have had ties to terrorists. And I'm watching this going, what universe is this
right,
in?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and so the Tucker Carlson with the bow tie who used to be on Crossfire with Paul Begala is not the Tucker Carlson there is today. You know, why is he doing this? The ratings are high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of, you throw the red meat out there, you know, but what does this lead to in terms of the amount of anger and rage in the population, especially if that's all you're watching?
Right.
You know, my apologies to Fox News viewers. I cannot watch their stuff at night. Now again, I'm not a big fan of MSNBC and CNN. I can't think of a single person I actually want to watch there.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it's mostly a personality thing as opposed to an ideological
right.
thing.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know, Jeremy. It's kind of like it's you know, it's I find it incredibly depressing.
Yeah, it sounds it was certainly challenging. Do you think it's fair to say that news coverage has become entertainment rather than education?
Well, I think news coverage is always to a certain extent entertainment. I mean, you know, we talk about the golden age of news.
Right.
you know, whatever is the 50s and maybe the 60s or
Walter
whatever.
Walter Cronkite's usually the person.
Yeah. Your grandpa, you know, out there telling you how to think. But remember that for large parts of American history, you know, the media was pretty partisan. You know, the Republican papers, Democratic papers.
William Randolph Hearst.
And they're scurrilous in terms of their denunciations of opponents.
Right.
You know, and people knew what they were getting, you know, so maybe I'm contradicting myself. Maybe we're just going back to the bad old days. The problem is that, you know, the reach of these things is much greater, you know, where you wake up in the morning, you have your coffee, you know, assuming there's water to have coffee with it, and and you go to your favorite blogs, you go to your favorite websites, you know, so you know, every morning I get up and I, you know, before my eyes are even open, I go to Politico, I go to 538, I go to the Washington Post, I go to the New York Times, and of course I go to SportsIllustrated.com.
That's where you start.
But now that the Yankees are out, it's kind of like, why
would
I care?
Who cares about the World Series? What's that Boston team called again?
You know, and I think everybody, you know, everybody else who does this. Now, remember one thing. Most Americans are not as obsessed with this stuff as I am. You know, I've got a PhD in political science. I've done politics my entire life. I can't stop myself from making political documentaries. Right. But there are other people that actually have lives. And now many of them are non-voters.
Right.
You know, because they have other things they're concentrating on.
Right.
You know, so that but I do think it's interesting, you know, in terms of what the future in terms of media might be. You know, I have no idea what's going to happen with Beto O'Rourke, okay? But his campaign has been really fascinating to watch. You know, if you believe that the future is less TV commercials and more Facebook Live, you know, where you were talking about how we know our politicians. You know, gosh, I mean, if you were following Beto O'Rourke, you got to know him as much as almost his immediate family.
Right.
You know, where he's just Facebook Live as he's driving from city to city around here.
Waiting for a Whataburger and playing the air drums. I mean.
But, you know, or skateboarding. It's forgetting whether you like him or you don't like him, you know, is this the future?
Right.
You know, the future of politics. Right. And if that's the case, you know, then boy, are we really going to get to know our candidates? You know, and how much of this is actually issue-based and how much is this, do I like the candidate or not? You know, do you want to see Ted Cruz, you know, Facebook Live, you know, hours on end? You know, Evan Smith had an interesting quote that I read, I guess maybe in the Tribune, and he said that O'Rourke and Cruz were both in their mid-40s, you know, but Cruz was running as an 80-year-old,
right,
and O'Rourke was running as a 20-year-old.
Absolutely right.
You know, the 80-year-old is relying on the old, you know, the old ways of doing stuff, and the 20-year-old is relying on youthful enthusiasm without a whole lot of experience in terms of how to run campaigns. We'll find out, you know, on election day, you know, if this actually works in terms of get out the vote, you know, in Texas, which is, again, a non-voting state. Right. But, you know, who knows?
And there was high turnout for the first day, at least. I mean, we certainly had.
Yeah. You know, that is not always an indication. You know, it's kind of like everybody's so pent up, they can't wait to vote.
We'll see what happens.
I'll wander over and vote right after we're done here. So,
Good. I'm glad you're doing that. What are, though, the opportunities for young people? I want us to spend the last 7 or 8 minutes on this. I mean, there's so many young people who want to get involved in politics, mm-hmm. who see the challenges that you've articulated so well.
Right.
And recognize, however, that these things change generation to generation. So what are the things, the areas of exploration? I mean, you're a super creative person. What are the things you're encouraging young people to do?
Well, I think everything is always storytelling.
Right.
You know, just storytelling in different mediums. You know, so even, you know, like, you know, old documentary filmmakers like me, you know, as opposed to telling war stories in class, are essentially just going, what kind of story do you want to tell? You know, and then how do you tell it well in your medium? Mm. You know, and again, it's a different thing for a 30-second commercial than a news piece, than, you know, like an hours and hours long film. You know, but it's also different in terms of just what can you get away with doing on, you know, stuff online. What can you get away with being Facebook Live? How long is somebody going to watch? You know, so you get the tools of telling a story, okay, and then you apply it to whatever medium there is. I mean, Jeremy, for old folks like us, or older folks like us, being your senior, who would have thought that you would read newspapers not only on your laptop, but on your phone?
That's amazing.
You know, who thought that you'd be reading emails on your watch?
Yeah.
You know, what's next? You know, like something implanted in your head? Well, maybe. You know, where you've got the old glasses that didn't seem to work, but maybe they will work at some point. And, you know, living in a virtual reality world. where, you know, in a battle camp or a war campaign, you'll put on your virtual reality glasses and you'll be there with them
right.
in that car,
right.
you know, driving to the panhandle
right.
for hours and hours right. and hours. Yeah, but that the younger folks will figure this out because they'll have to be able to reach an audience.
Right.
You know, financially, if nothing else, you have to be able to sell stuff,
right.
you know, as a maker of material. And, you know, they'll figure that out. It's probably, you know, I'll be sitting there with Moses on top of a mountain looking over to the promised land.
Issuing some more commandments, I'm sure.
Sure to myself, at least.
What about the nature of storytelling, though? I know something you've thought a lot about, because with each change in the nature of the media that you've gone through so well here, the way stories are told
sure.
changes.
Yeah, I don't want to go Joseph Campbell here,
yeah.
you know, with the hero of with the ages or whatever, but... You know, stories depend on characters.
Right, right.
Okay.
I think there's something to Campbell's work, actually.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. But it's the stories depend on characters, compelling characters. You know, why do you like the movie that you just saw? Okay, because the character spoke to you. Mm-hmm. There's something about them that compelled you. And it works the same way in politics. You know, again, I don't know, you know, what's going to happen in the O'Rourke-Cruz race. I really don't. But I've never seen anything like, you know, what's happening, you know, with the sort of general, you know, hysteria of his supporters around Beto O'Rourke.
Right, right.
You know, the guy's got something. And I think when you see that, and there were other candidates that have that, you know, quite frankly, Donald Trump, you know, won without the popular vote in 2016 because he was a very unique character.
Right.
You know, and, you know, the news media couldn't stop covering him because it was kind of like, you know, like, what will he say next?
Right.
You know, so political elites might look down and go, oh, you know, he can't win after saying that. He can't win after saying that. And he just kept saying it, you know, and so that he created his own persona.
Right.
Okay, so we're talking about stories that are really driven by characters that, you know, we can't stop watching.
And isn't there always, in different times, in different media spaces, isn't there always the allure of the story of youthful integrity and new frontiers? I'm thinking of Theodore Roosevelt,
right.
John F. Kennedy,
right.
Barack Obama,
right.
Beto O'Rourke, right?
Yeah. Yeah, of course, then how do you explain, you know, 70-ish, you know, year-old Donald Trump winning the presidency? You know, it's always the eternal cliche battle between experience counts and it's time for a change.
Right. But of course, Trump was running against another 70-year-old.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
That might have been part of the issue, right? That there was no youthful alternative.
Yeah, sure. You know, it really depends. It's kind of like, you know, you always have a sense of which candidate, you know, has more of a bump, you know, because of those, you know, personality traits, that kind of youth, whatever. But every campaign is different, you know, and there's some younger candidates who are duds and they're some old folks that are just very lively.
Right.
You know, there's no one way of looking at this. But I think in terms of stories, again, you're looking for characters that are compelling and they have a story to tell.
Yes.
And every character has, every presidential candidate now has a book.
Right.
You know, it's yeah. like the same book.
Right.
You know,
Both
over and over again. We right. all struggled. We were right. all born in a log cabin.
Right.
So I saw Ken Burns's film, Huey Long, I was showing in class the other day, and Huey used to talk about being born in a log cabin. They had a picture of this log cabin. It was like a three-story building.
Exactly.
His sister laughing about how, yeah, it had logs in it.
A luxury log cabin.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is the strength of your work, of course. I mean, because George Wallace and Ann Richards, two very different people, and Molly Ivins,
mm-hmm.
Three very different people. I mean, these are larger-than-life characters.
Sure, sure. And that's why you're drawn to them. You know, as a filmmaker here in Austin, I never would have guessed that I would have gotten to know on some basis Molly Ivins and Ann Richards, you know, in the film that we just finished, the short film Molly and Ann, you know, makes use of footage that we shot of them, you know, in the years right before they passed away.
Yeah. Ann Richards, governor, of course, of Texas, and Molly Ivins, the great columnist and humorist.
Yeah, yeah, and they were larger-than-life characters.
They really were.
You know, that's partially why, you know, they were so compelling to people then and why so many people remember them now. So they're wonderful subjects. You know, as a filmmaker, you want to be able to work with material of people that were that interesting, and also there's some sort of video, visual record to be able to make something out of.
They're really interesting, and they matter, right?
Yeah.
Those things together. So the last question I wanted to close on, and I think it sort of is in the architecture of everything you've said so well today, Paul. There's a mystery about all this. I mean, you've been studying this all your life. You have a PhD mm-hmm. in political science, and in the best way. I mean, someone who's actually really studying politics, not
right.
political theory. And you've covered this in so many ways. But yet, as you said so many times, we really don't know what's going to happen with Beto and Cruz, and we really don't know what things are going to look like in the media space in the next few years. Why does it remain so mysterious?
Because people are mysterious. You know, it's God, who was it that wrote My Antonio? Willa Cather?
I think that's right.
Yeah, there's a wonderful quote. I should remember this. It's hanging over my desk where it says that people tell just two or three stories, but they tell them over and over and over again.
Right.
You know, and they always differ because of the internal passion and the characters they bring with it. You know, we're not all that different. You know, we're born, we live, we die. We have relationships. You know, and some of them are just more interesting than others.
Yeah.
Every life is interesting. You know, every life has a narrative, you know, so that there's always a mystery. There isn't a mystery to where it eventually ends up, but there's a mystery in terms of just how that life gets led. You know, which choices do you make? Which goes one way and which goes another way? For me as a political documentarian, that's what I try to work on. You know, why did somebody do something and not do something else? Why was a choice made here which changed history? You know, or won an election, and what was the consequences of winning that election? Sometimes winning an election seems great on election night, and it leads to a lot of pain and defeat in the future.
Right.
So, you know, that's what makes this interesting. If you're a political junkie, obsessed as I am, it's endlessly entertaining.
Well, and it echoes what Karl von Clausewitz, the great sort of military theorist, said, which is that the simplest things are actually the most difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the excitement for me is because it's a mystery, and we kind of know the stories, but how the stories play out are going to be different with each year and each generation. That's such an opportunity for young people to figure out a new way to tell the story and take the story in a new way. And in a sense, Beto O'Rourke, regardless of what happens in the election, has shown us that possibility.
Yeah, I agree.
Zachary, what do you think? I mean, do you and your friends think about political stories? What draws you in to these conversations?
Well, I think that you were both correct, that I think that stories and the compelling stories are really what draws young people in, I think. Because, and also the way that Beto is able to connect with younger people through the use of things like Facebook Live and more social media campaigns. And I think that it's really important for candidates, if they're trying to reach out to young people, to not focus on simple, like, red and blue issues, but actually just talk about people's everyday lives. And I think what Beto's done really well is make himself seem like an ordinary person.
Right, an authentic person in this.
And I think Cruz has tried to do that, but had trouble because he's been in politics for so long.
So you and your friends are drawn to the stories of the new candidates in particular.
Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been a tremendous conversation. Paul, you've educated us on so many of these issues, given us a history and a context for understanding the present. And you've mixed some very honest assessment of our challenges with some hope. And I think that's what we need today more than ever. Thank you for joining this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.